Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 13, lucky number 13 of Real Blend, a podcast that is war ready.
War ready.
Thank you, boys. I appreciate that. Actually, we are a podcast aimed at film geeks that is hosted by film geeks, and it doesn't get more passionate than the three co-hosts of Real Blend. My name is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor here at Cinema Blend. And as always, I'm joined for Real Blend, our weekly live podcast here on the Cinema Blend Network, by my co-hosts, starting with Kevin McCarthy, who is the entertainment reporter at Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hello, Kevin.
Sean, I just want to let you know that I am officially war ready today.
Thank you.
I am officially war ready. I don't know about Jake. I know Gabe, our producer's war ready, but
always.
I think Jake's kind of like in mid ready. He's kind of like, he's like pre-war ready.
I didn't like the first one when it was directed by the guy who just won Best Director, so I have a feeling I'm not going to like this one.
Well, Jake Hamilton is entertainment reporter for Fox 32 in Chicago. Jake is, we should tell everybody who's happened to be watching this show live, he's 3 hours away from seeing Ready Player One.
Yes!
And he's tingling with geeky excitement.
Yes.
So if you are tuning in to us for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes and all episodes to come on iTunes, on Google Play, on Spotify, and just about everywhere that podcasts are served. So go back and find some of our old episodes. But like I said,
Jake,
this is number 13.
Jake, by the way, legally changed his middle name to Cheese Pizza last week. So after we got off the air, his middle name is now Jake Cheese Pizza Hamilton.
And I stand by it. No, I have more flavor. I'd like to think I have more flavor.
For people who don't know what we're talking about, last week we were talking about Star Wars and Han Solo, and Jake was essentially saying that Jon Favreau is the cheese pizza of directors.
No, they're talking about... They're talking about the TV show.
That's what you said, though.
No, I stand by it. I like Favreau. Even Ron Howard has more flavor as a director than Jon Favreau does.
This is getting a little bit out of hand. I'm offended for Favreau, and
what am I doing? Howard blend.
Yeah, soon, Howard very blend. Soon. All right. So for people who don't know the show and might not understand what that reference is, we also like to play a fun game, and that will be in the second half of the podcast, where we pick a filmmaker who we love, put the hashtag, their last name, and blend, and then we debate about what their best film is. And this week's episode is Scorsese blend. So we're going to get to debate the best films of Martin Scorsese, but
Sean,
before we get to that, yes, Kevin.
Can we recap what we gave real quick, just so people, like, in case people are tuning in for the first time and they're finding
great
our podcast?
Idea. That's a great idea, because actually, someone on Twitter was saying, oh, you guys should do Spielberg, and then they said, you guys should do Nolan, and we did. We started this experiment with Christopher Nolan, where Kevin said his favorite film was
Interstellar. I forgot we did Nolan. That feels so long ago.
Jake said his favorite film was Dark Knight.
Not favorite,
Rises.
Best. Wait, best or favorite?
We did best. Nolan movie. I went Interstellar, Jake went Dark Knight, and then Sean went Prestige.
Prestige, right. Okay. Then we did Spielberg, and Kevin went Jaws.
Right.
Jake also went Jaws.
Yes, I did.
And I went E.T., and then Scorsese. Is Scorsese our third one?
No, we did Kubrick.
And Jake and I both went 2001, and Kevin went The Shining.
And don't forget Paul Thomas Anderson blend.
Oh my gosh, I'm forgetting that. We've done a lot of these episodes.
We have done a lot of these.
That's exciting.
And I think I did Boogie Nights.
I think we
all
did Boogie
three
Nights.
Of us did Boogie
yeah.
Nights.
We all did Boogie Nights, yeah.
Yes, so we've normally been 2-2-1.
Yeah. And today, by the way, I'll give a little tease since we're all here. None of us know each other's best Scorsese choice, but we were just told by Gabe, our producer, that all three of us picked three different movies.
That's cool.
I think when we get to that point of the show today, I'm hoping that we can kind of predict each other's choices if we can do that. It's kind of fun.
We're going to guess.
I have no idea what Jake chose. I think I have an idea of what Sean chose, but that's about
it. I think I know what Jake
chose. I'm so predictable. I guess I can be read at this point. So we're going to get to that. Before we get to that point, let's kick off with some of the biggest news stories that we like to normally start the podcast. There was an Avengers Infinity War trailer, which I'm sure everybody's seen at this point. But I want to get to these predictions for the opening weekend of what Infinity War might be. We've had a conversation on the podcast about whether Black Panther might outgross Infinity War. I started to slide over to that side that said that Black Panther will outgross Infinity War, that Infinity War won't catch up to it. And now I'm changing my mind because this thing shattered Fandango's ticket records.
6 hours.
In 6 hours. And then, Kevin, I think you heard, what was the number you heard? 245 million?
That was just a number that came across my Twitter timeline. I have no idea if that's actually a legitimate prediction. But I will say, last week prior to the trailer coming out, I was 100% on the side of Black Panther is going to have the biggest opening. Infinity War won't touch it. And my specific reasoning behind that was, look at the opening for Captain America Civil War. They had $179 million opening weekend. That had everybody in it. But I'm telling you right now, that trailer, when that thing hit, and then the records that it broke, also at 179 million views in 24 hours, plus the Wakanda element of the storyline as well, I think I am 100% flipping my side now. I'm John Carrying here, and I think that it's definitely going to be, I think it's going to blow Black Panther out of the water in 3 days.
But in order to do that, doesn't it theoretically have to be on every screen in almost every theater?
But does that now? That with The Last Jedi, they enter into these deals with theaters where they say, we're not going to give you the right to play our movie unless it's on 80% of your screens, and it stays on 80% of your screens for 4 weeks. And then it's on a certain number of screens. They get 80% of the profits, and that they stay on those screens for at least 4 weeks before you start backing it off. They started doing that with The Last Jedi, and a lot of mom and pop theaters sort of were crying out saying, you can't do that because we can't afford to keep a movie on a majority of our screens for 4 weeks. So we have to have the turnaround. But because they're Disney, they have the right to do that, and I would fully imagine that they're going to do that for Infinity War.
I don't know why this just came to my mind. This is totally random ADD thought, but I remember when I went to, this is back when all the movie theaters used to have film projectors, when Revenge of the Sith came out, I remember going to a movie theater and every screen the night that movie came out was Revenge of the Sith, but when they only had like 6 or 7 prints of the movie, so they had to interloop it to each projector.
What?
There were 22 screens. It was an AMC Hoffman in Alexandria, Virginia, and I believe, I don't quote me on the number of prints, I think it was like 5 or 6, but they would interloop it and like 3 or 4 projectors would keep on the same movie. It's like
so
insane.
Did they have to keep, like, were they like moving for one reel to
it
another
would jump
projector?
Across. Yeah, so basically, like, it would, like, the movie, let's say projector one's right here.
Yeah.
You would have the movie playing, and then as it was being thread through the projector as you were watching it, it would then be moved. It would all like be moved to the other projector. And
dude, that gives me anxiety just hearing that.
I know. That's how they used to do the.
Wow.
Now everything's on a hard drive, so it's like completely different. But yeah, going back to the Avengers thing, there's no doubt in my mind now that movie's going to have the number one. It's going to be the number one opening ever, right? In 3 days. What's the record right now?
I have no clue what
still,
the record is.
It's still Force Awakens.
Was that 240 something? What was the What's the Force Awakens 3 day?
Someone, if only we had small handheld devices that could.
Yeah, that is the highest.
I mean, rate. While you're looking that up, I know that people were sharing photos of the ArcLight Cinema in Los Angeles when Black Panther opened, and their ticket board was okay. Just Black Panther. Yeah. You know, every theater, every time. But the thing is, like. I got Fandango tickets for opening weekend. I'm assuming there's going to be a press screening. I hope I'll get to see it in advance. But like for opening weekend, my wife and kids were both like, yeah, we got to go see that opening weekend. It's starting to feel like that event type picture that's going to drive people to theaters on opening weekend.
But
248,
also,
that's going to be tough to beat 248.
Oh, 248 was Force Awakens. See, that's the question. So so Avengers 1 did what? 207? And then we figured out the other day that Avengers 2 was either short or a little bit higher. I think it was shorter than that. But right. Yeah.
But Avengers 2 just didn't have the buzz. Like, it wasn't the event that both Avengers and Infinity War feel like.
Also, the trailer was amazing. Yeah. So it's like one of those things where when that trailer hit, it shook cinematic world. I mean, I was in L.A., covering Ready Player One, I think the day that hit, and I was like, and it was like, it just blew up. Everyone was like, everyone was getting excited again. Because to me, like, you know, the thing I love about movies nowadays is that when we get that event picture, when Panther was in theaters, it was like, I felt like it felt like a great moment in the world. You know what I mean? Like, it was like everybody was like talking about cinema. Cinema was everywhere. Black Panther was everywhere. It was like the most tweeted about movie of all time. 35 million tweets.
There, I saw that. Literally the most tweeted about movie of all time.
Ever. So to me, I think Avengers is going to have that, but also the success of Black Panther. Someone said this the other day. I don't know if it was one of you guys, and that everybody who saw Black Panther that wasn't necessarily a Marvel fan, because that movie was such a standalone movie, it worked by itself. You didn't need to see the other Marvel films. So everybody who wants to see continuation of Shuri, Danai Gurira's character, Black Panther, seeing them in Wakanda fighting with Captain America, whatever they're doing, it's going to be awesome.
Well, it's almost like we're getting a Black Panther sequel
right,
3 months already. After Black Panther comes out.
Yeah. Also, what that trailer did for the casual fan who hasn't been paying that close attention to the fact that all these team-ups are happening, that trailer leaned into Iron Man and Star-Lord together.
Yes.
Spider-Man with Doctor Strange and the Hulk. And I think casual fans were just like, oh my God, wait a second. Everyone's in this and they're
this
all hanging out like this?
This is not just a normal superhero movie. This is a big deal.
Yeah, this is a big deal. All right, so earlier this week, we were doing a text chain, the normal text chain that we do between shows where we talk about all the things that are interesting to us, and I was sharing the fact that Cinema Blend, not me, but Cinema Blend was able to go to Ireland
on the
trip of a lifetime. I know. We went to, so we sent Eric Eisenberg, one of our intrepid reporters, to Dublin, Ireland, where this was part of the Last Jedi DVD release, the Blu-ray release, and Disney put together this trip that was, you arrive in Dublin on St. Patrick's Day and you interview Mark Hamill, who was taking part in the parade through Dublin. And then from there, you get on a bus and you tour all of these locations where they shot Last Jedi, where Rian Johnson shot Last Jedi. And it culminated with a trip, a boat trip to Skellig Michael, which is the rocky island, for people who might not know, the rocky island where Luke Skywalker's character was stationed for the majority of Last Jedi. And it got us talking about physical locations from films that we love that the three of us would love to get a chance to go to. And then in the text chain, we started sharing like places that we were able to go. And I was pretty stunned at the number of places that we've been to ourselves. I know both of you guys have done Hawaii, where I know Jurassic Park and a few other films were shot. What else did you see when you were there? Oh, you did the Lost tour.
I did the Lost tour. Well, I'm obsessed with Lost. So, and whenever I'd done it, it had been wrapped up by that point, but there were still quite a few things there. Lost was a big part of sort of my coming into my obsession with pop culture. Lost was will and always will be my favorite TV show of all time, just because it was right before Netflix broke out this binge-worthy thing, so it was still this event to watch it week for week and get together with your friends afterwards and chat about the Signs and what it meant. And Entertainment Weekly used to have this amazing writer named Doc Jensen who used to write these incredibly in-depth recaps about what, like, the trees were pointing north. And in 1800, there was this book about trees pointing north. And we used to just pick it apart. And, of course, it all ended up being crap, and none of it ended up meaning anything. But it was just... anyway, so going back to it, it was cool to sort of do that. Also, Jurassic Park is my favorite Spielberg movie of all time. Kevin, I know you got to do that tour as well. I think we did it at different junkets, because I don't think you and I ever did a Hawaii junket together. But they set up the, you know, but we did, we got to do Rio together, you and I.
Yeah, we did Rio together. But yeah, Jurassic Park, I mean, my wife and I, ever since we've been together, we specifically seek out filming locations everywhere we go, no matter what city or country we're in. But yeah, the Jurassic Park one that Jake mentioned, I remember we did a picture side by side. We sat under that log that Sam Neill and the kids are under as the dinosaurs are jumping over. I just rewatched Jurassic Park this weekend. I'm just so amazed. It really truly blows my mind that the effects in that movie look better than Jurassic World. And I'm like, how is that
without
possible?
Question. Because he only used effects if he had to. They built those beautiful T-Rex heads.
Yeah.
And he was smart enough to obviously put that scene in the rain. Obviously, it adds drama to put it in the rain. But it obviously kind of hides whatever problems with it they needed to hide. I mean, that rain sequence is just absolutely astounding. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable. I'm with you 100%.
Okay. Hold on, I have to butt in because some of our viewers who are playing along, Kevin Nguyen, I might be mispronouncing that, chimes in and says that he went to, Kevin, are you ready for this? Monrovia High School, where not another teen movie was filmed.
Yes!
I was just there. I was literally just there. My wife and that's
Kevin, you did not make a mistakey.
I know. By the way, for people who are just tuning in, I love Not Another Teen Movie. I think it's a brilliant script, and I'll stand by it. I have no problem saying that. I'm sure I'll lose all credibility, but I think that movie's amazing.
Brilliant script? That's the word we're going to use?
Listen, here's the thing. That movie gets put into a category of spoof, so therefore the word spoof ends up not being able to be allowed to be a good movie. So those, to me, it's unfair to the comedy genre that films like that can't be considered to be great because of what they are. That's a whole nother argument. I think that script is amazing. But yeah, I went to that same school location. That's also where She's All That was filmed, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I'll say Buffy. That's the Buffy school.
Yeah. But I mean, like my wife and I, when we first started dating, we went everywhere. We went to the when Harry Met Sally, where they have the scene where she's faking the she's doing the screaming element, and then it wasn't Reiner's mom sitting there for the scene.
She's the one who says she's having. Yeah,
yeah.
Did you say that's Katz's Deli?
Katz's Deli.
Yeah, I've been there.
One of the best locations I ever went to, though, to me, and they closed it down, was the restaurant where they filmed the De Niro Pacino Heat scene.
Yes.
And I sat at that table. I mean, that's one of the greatest scenes in the history of cinema. And just to like be at that, I can't remember the name of the restaurant off the top of my head. It was in Beverly Hills, and it was just awesome. But yeah, I mean, I've been to the Inception Bridge. We've gone.
And talking about favorite TV shows, you did the New Mexico tour of Breaking Bad.
Yeah, and I will say I regret. So Jake actually was on the Breaking Bad train way before I was, and he actually told me to get into it. And I was like, because TV shows at the time, it was also one of those things. I was working two jobs. I had no time to like sit down and actually watch TV every week. And I wanted to, and Breaking Bad is one that I wish I could have done, like Jake just said about Lost. I wish I could have watched it every week and had that anticipation and broke things down. You know, what's going to happen with the Gus story? I mean,
was it over by the time you started it?
I watched the first episode of Breaking Bad the night the finale aired.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know
that. I think that's what it was. I'll have to check with Lauren. We watched it in 2013 or 14 is when we started it. But I will say, yeah, we rented a car in Albuquerque and we just drove all around. I'll tell you a funny story about that. I was interviewing the cast of Black Panther recently, and Daniel Kaluuya, I sat down and I had a Breaking Bad tie bar pin on, and Daniel looks at that and he goes, "Oh my God, I've done the Breaking Bad tour." I'm like, "What do you mean?" He rented a car, the guy from Get Out rented a car and drove around to every, he said he bought the fake candy blue meth. There's a rock candy seller in Albuquerque who makes the blue candy looks like the meth from the show. But yeah, that to me was my favorite location scouting. We did the car wash. I met the people who live in the house where they film the exteriors for Walter White's house.
They hate it now, don't they?
Oh, dude, they have a whole camera set up because people were going by and putting pizzas on the roof.
Pizzas, yeah.
Like Walter did. So they had to like put actual security cameras. They sit out there. I actually had a great conversation with them because it is kind of annoying now that people just go by their house all the time. But it is, I would just move out. I mean, come on. That house is going to be iconic forever. So,
Sean, what's your favorite?
Well, I have one that I still haven't been to, and I'm kind of stunned that I haven't made it to it, and that's Nakatomi Plaza. I mean, I know that the building that they use in Los Angeles that's a stand-in for Nakatomi, that the first Die Hard is my favorite movie of all time whenever people reference
it. I don't think
like,
I knew that.
With a vengeance. Yeah.
No. Mm. Hold on. Mm. Wait a second. Mm-hmm. That is a podcast for another time.
Yeah.
You know what? The hardest part is just that, like, trying to come up with ideas for this topic, it was like there's so many, like, people don't location shoot anymore. It's so hard to do it that, like, it's all sets on, it's not even back lots. It's like, you know, it's all green screen stuff because I know I took the Universal Studios tour one time for a junket we were on years ago, and you got to see
the Back to the Future. Psycho.
Yeah, and the Back to the Future Square, you know, where the clock tower was, and they preserved a lot of that stuff. And I was like, oh, this is amazing. I wish that this stuff was out in public, but you can't do it. You're just not able to do it anymore. So,
dude, a good one to visit, by the way, is in New York. You can actually go to the exterior Ghostbusters firehouse.
Rewatched Ghostbusters the other day.
That's in Brooklyn, I believe. I visit. It looks exactly like it. It's the exterior, of course. A lot of these things are exterior shots. Yeah. A lot of them are exteriors.
Who has done the Lord of the Rings tour in New Zealand?
Kevin did that.
Kevin did that, and that was good?
Yeah, don't tell my wife, but I specifically wanted to go there for our honeymoon so I could go to New Zealand and visit the and visit Hobbiton. No, but seriously, it was the most glorious thing ever. You were like, it's literally real. I mean, it's not like it's physically there. They have actual hobbit holes. They're built on these beautiful green hills. It is one of the most incredibly gorgeous things I've ever seen. And
Kevin, be honest. You did not go there for your honeymoon. You went there, and it just so happened to also be your honeymoon.
No. Yeah. So what ended up, the honest truth is, I've always wanted to go to New Zealand and Australia. My wife actually wanted to do more of a like beachy resort type thing. So we compromised. I only wanted to go to that part of New Zealand. You can go to two parts of New Zealand, north and south. I went to that part because I wanted to go to Hobbiton. We could have gone to the south, but I went to the north just so I could go to Hobbiton. That was the whole point of that.
Well, and talking about places I'd like to go really quick before we move on. Not that far from Chicago, so it's kind of annoying that I haven't gone yet. I'd like to do the Field of Dreams house. It's in Dyersville, Iowa. It's probably about a 6-hour drive from here. And they just announced this week that actually you can sleep there. I would love to. I mean, Field of Dreams is like one of those like you know, touches the heart movies for me. Grew up with it. And I would just feel like it would be like a really emotionally cathartic experience throwing a ball out in that field.
Jake, awesome. When you got your job in Chicago, this is a cool story. I don't know if you could tell it real quick. You actually had to go out and shoot some things. Like, tell this is a cool story about it involves the Dark Knight.
Whenever I was being interviewed, one of the pitches that sort of I was kind of pitching myself with was that I was self-sufficient and could do stories on my own. And so the guy that was interviewing me said, okay, like you've got a phone, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, you can edit stuff on that phone, right? And I said, yeah. He said, you've got 90 minutes to shoot a story and bring it back to me. And looked at his and I sort of was stumbling, and he goes, it's less than like 89 minutes, 50 seconds. So I instantly Googled famous places in Chicago where they shot movies, ran around, took a cab to every single, you know, as many as I could, about 10 of them, shot footage on my phone, wrote a script on a napkin, and tracked it into my phone, edited it together on my phone, and had it, you know, sprinting back. And shot a lot of stuff, you know, just in downtown Chicago. It's where a lot of scenes where they shot The Dark Knight, Ferris Bueller,
Untouchables,
Road to Perdition. So many films. I mean, it was incredibly easy. I mean, I'm literally, I kid you not, I don't want to give too much away about where I live, but I'm literally looking out my window right now at a place where they shot The Dark Knight.
Where's the street in The Dark Knight where they flipped the 18-wheeler? Where's the, that?
That's like sort of like the, what it was considered like the financial building. So
Dear Lower Wacker, isn't there?
Lower Wacker is where the chase sequence takes place.
God, that blew my mind. Yeah. I remember like Nolan had like that whole scene is practical. Nolan had like a catapult underneath. They have built a hole. They lifted this truck in the air, and everything else was real. Like it's unbelievable how they did that scene.
And you talk to like the news crews here in Chicago, and they'll tell you about the summer that they shot Batman here and how, like, I mean, you could kind of just go sit. We have in our newsroom, in our archives, we have just generic footage of all of those shots being shot. Like they got to go to the set of when they blew up the hospital, like all that stuff. We have just raw footage of it. It's fantastic.
And that hospital, they really blew up. The only thing they added some like CG explosions in the window. Where is that? What is that hospital now?
I think it was an abandoned hospital. So okay. I don't think it was too difficult for them to. But yeah, we've got raw footage of just about everything.
That's right, crazy.
We can't go too deep into this next topic because the rest of everybody has to, like, everybody, including two co-hosts on this podcast, can't talk in depth about it. But Kevin saw Ready Player One, and I just want to discuss briefly, because Jake is a few
Ready
hours
Player
from
One.
Seeing it.
2.5 hours away from seeing it, baby.
Kevin, keep it very brief, but you have said
and
you put it in your top 10 Spielberg so far, right?
Yeah, it was an incredible experience. And the thing about Ready Player One that's beautiful is that there's like this balance where simultaneously you're like blown away by the references, but they never overstep the boundary into taking away from the story. There's a great story. I mean, I love the whole concept of the movie, the message of the movie, the idea of taking this leap. It's an interesting story. It's a hard sell. I get that when you watch the trailer, it's kind of hard to kind of take all in. But they do a really good job of opening the film, explaining what it is, but never over-explaining it. They never dumb it down. It is, first of all, the technology that Spielberg used for this movie, the VR capabilities they were doing, he was able to put on VR goggles and look into the digital sets and block his actors. It's sick how they pulled this off.
Let me ask a question.
His job has changed so much since he made Jaws. Yeah. It's insane.
Well, because of that, yeah. like... Without really saying this, like, is there a movie that he's done that you can almost say that this is in line with? Because I'm afraid that, like Tintin is so CGI and tech-heavy. Yeah. Does it feel like that? Or does it have an adventurous tone like a Raiders or a Jurassic?
See, it's interesting. I would actually... Because there were elements in Tintin that had a Raiders element to them, just the way the action was designed. The beauty of Ready Player One is that you do have that human aspect to it once you get into the real world. And I don't know the exact time frames of how he did this, but I know the real world stuff was shot on film, and then he did some digital stuff with the Oasis. But it is like the transitions between the real world and the Oasis are kind of what keep the film on this grounded element of reality. And it is... I'm telling you right now, I can't wait for you guys to see it. I can't wait to talk about it. I hope you guys love it because I'm just obsessed with it. I've seen it twice. I'm going for a third time next week. And it just, Alan Silvestri's score. I mean, Spielberg said this in my interview with him. You don't get scores like this anymore. Like, this is like a classic, like he said in the interview, that's a bad guy theme. Like, there's always like, it's almost like you're watching a classic film that you grew up watching. But then you have this updated technology. Performance-wise, Ben Mendelsohn, that guy just always blows my mind. Right. Also,
dude, you need to see Bloodline. If you love Ben Mendelsohn, you got to see Bloodline.
Bloodline, well, or just first the first two seasons.
Season. Yeah, I'd argue two. Even just the first season.
Yeah, that's the third season's awful.
Oh, it's really awful.
I'm also a huge Mark Rylance fan, and I think but I also loved him in
from
Dunkirk.
BFG.
Yeah, yeah, but Bridge of Spies, he's amazing in. And I still think Stallone deserved the Academy Award, but that's a whole other situation. But
okay, let me ask you something about Mark Rylance. Whenever Spielberg was in early stages of making this movie, he went after Gene Wilder. Obviously, Gene Wilder hadn't passed yet. How great would that role have been if it had been Gene Wilder?
That would have been amazing.
I actually wish I could have asked him that question.
You could have.
Now, I could have asked it, but I honestly... Now, for people who don't know how junkets work, he was paired with Ty Sheridan and Olivia Cooke, so it was a very... I had to, like, kind of map it out. That was a tough interview.
It's tough, and also for people that don't do interviews, and this is such, like, a niche thing that we can all say, like, oh, we understand this. It is tough when you have an amazing director in a room paired with actors, because ask them two different types of questions, but you get the same amount of time. So it's tough to ask a question... You know, and also, like, not to knock the two lead actors in this film, but when you get in a room with Spielberg, you want to get Spielberg talking. And unfortunately, you know, I think we've all been in situations before where we've had an amazing director paired with, you know, even a great actor. But when one of them's the person that you don't want as much as talking, in your head, all you're thinking is stop talking so the other person could start talking.
Yeah, I remember like sitting there and I love so Olivia Cooke and she's answering her question and I'm like, I know my time is running out. And Spielberg's like sitting right in front of me. I had my Jaws shoes on. I was like in a total like nerd out session. But yeah, but anyways, I know we'll talk about it next week, but the movie is amazing. I'm excited for people to see it. I hope Jake, text me when you get out of it. Yeah.
It's not short, right? Isn't it almost 2:30?
It's 2:20. And I'm telling you right now, and I know people have been like ruining certain things, but there are so many surprises. Just stay away from the reviews. The second act, I think people are just going to be really blown away by what happens there.
I can tell you honestly, I had something ruined for me just because I was reading a review by a big publication. So I honestly thought it would be safe because I thought, well, a major publication isn't going to spoil something. And apparently it was something that Kevin says in the press conference, someone started to mention and Spielberg cut off that person.
Right. Yeah, our buddy Eric from Fandango hosts the press conference. I remember reading a transcript that came out, like someone had posted a partial element of the transcript, or somebody brought up a spoiler to Spielberg, and he like literally shut it down. Like, he wouldn't answer the question. And to me, it's something that I would be interested in knowing, but it was almost it was too early to talk about it. But Ready Player One's amazing. I'm excited to see it. One other thing I will say before we move on. The beauty of Ready Player One, and Jake, when you see it tonight, is how clean the action is. Every single bit of the action is visible. There's not, like, it's not quick cut. It's not, like, trying to trick you. And again, a lot of it is VFX and visual effects, but it looks unbelievable. I mean, there is something to be said about watching, as Jake, you tweeted this too, about watching a T-Rex from Jurassic Park chase a DeLorean. Yeah. I mean, it's like the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. It's awesome.
Okay, I was just going to say one last question before, and I think one of the things, you know, we were just talking about how timeless something like Jurassic Park is because of his lack of special effects. How well will this movie age?
It's an interesting question, and it is very strange to think about that because it is so CG heavy, but in my mind, when you're watching the movie, you know you're looking at virtual reality. So, like, your brain...
It's
your
part
brain,
of the plot. Okay, that makes
right,
sense.
Right. Your brain's in virtual reality. So everything is... I mean, everything's a bit exaggerated. Olivia Cooke's eyes are, like, this big. You know, it's like, you know, when you're watching the movie, you're never in your mind going, that's real life. So you know it's a video game.
It's similar aspect to watching... If you were to watch the original Tron today, you're like, well, that's a video game in the 80s. So, like, that's what it looks
yeah,
like.
Yeah. It's interesting. You'll see what I mean. When you see the movie, you'll see what I mean. There's never a mindset where I was like, okay, that looks too fake because you know you're in virtual reality. But there are there's some really cool stuff. Like when they go into like the archives of Halliday's mind and like how what he left behind, like when they go into these real, like with Simon Pegg, there's some really cool visuals how they pulled that off. But Jake, when you see the chase scene in the beginning, that like that whole like race scene, which you see in the trailer, wait till you see what they do with the sound design. The sound design's nuts.
And I'm seeing it in a true IMAX theater. So
okay, yeah, Brian, who's crazy. Watching us. Hey, Brian, thank you very much for submitting a question. He's going to ask this, and then we're going to transition on. How many times, Kevin, do you think that we actually need to see the movie to catch all of the Easter eggs?
Good question.
I don't even think Spielberg knows every reference in the movie. No, I'm being serious. I think that I say that in a good way because there is so much in this movie. And I'm sure Spielberg, obviously, he had to. I mean, I was joking. He had to check off everyone that was in the movie. He's the director. But I was talking to one of the actors after I left my interview about my favorite reference in the whole movie, which I'm not going to say what it is. But I told the reference to Ben Mendelsohn, and he goes, oh, that's what that was?
Funny.
I had no idea. And I remember talking to the actor who actually performed this particular reference, and at the time of shooting it, they didn't even know that's what they were doing. So, because the character...
Wow.
Because what I mean... Because the character...
Let's do it next week. Let's do
you
it
don't
next week.
Need...
Let's do it next week. Next Thursday, but even at
it's
that,
amazing.
We're not going to do spoilers. We'll save spoilers for another conversation. But at least next week, all of us will have seen it. And
oh, Sean, I'm going to text you so many
fine.
Spoilers tonight.
It's part of this job.
Jake, I'm curious if you pick up on one the first time. There's one. Just pay attention.
Stop.
Well,
stop,
I mean,
stop,
I'm not very smart.
Stop.
So
yeah, just stop. All three of us are giving you the stop. It's terrible. Okay, this week, since you have to wait another week to see Ready Player One, this week instead you can go see Pacific Rim 2. And I was going to use something that you said earlier.
Man.
Have all three of us seen it?
I haven't, but feel free to spoil it.
It's not spoiling anything. People should go see it.
I know, but I'm saying, like, you're cool.
You can
like,
spoil
you
it?
Can
that's
spoil
fine.
Things.
I
that's
actually great. Enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun with it. And one of the
did
things,
like the
one of the reasons
one?
Why I enjoyed it, yes, I did like the first one a lot. It's really funny. The first one, I can't take the first one outside of this context. It's my oldest son's favorite movie. Like, the first Pacific Rim to him is what Star Wars is to us. Because the first time he saw it, I mean, dude, he was... Okay, so it's two years ago, so he was, like, 11 or 12.
Yeah.
So it's...
Which is, like, I feel like if I saw Pacific Rim when I was 11 or 12, it would also be my
That's exactly
favorite.
It. It's an IMAX-size movie about, you know, robots punching creatures that come from down below. And so... Any road trip that we go on or went on for the past 2 years, like it's playing on a DVD in the back. And I just know all the dialogue from it and every noise from it because I just hear him listening to it. So
did he go
he
with
went
you
last night?
Night
and he loved it. He actually thought that the trailers Fantastic. Leading up to it looked a little bit cartoonish. He was like, I don't think this is going to be as good. But I thought the story.
Why is he not on this
he
podcast?
He should probably be on this podcast.
Yeah. Is this PJ?
Yeah,
PJ. Where is
He's
PJ?
Back home. I'm actually in St. Louis. So we should have pulled him in. But I just thought, like, Kevin, what you said about Spielberg, the way he directed his action, this is Steven DeKnight who took over for Guillermo del Toro, and I just was really impressed with the way he handled the scope of his action. The action sequences, he does something in the middle of all of these big battles, and so there's these massive confrontations between these Jaegers, the skyscraper robots, and the kaiju, and there's just city devastation, but he constantly cuts down to, like, the street level and shows you, like, a foot smashing a car and people scurrying. So you're always reminded of just like how this is still taking place in the real world, how it's affecting the stuff that's going on around it. And that kept to me, it kept it grounded in a place where the movie's so comically, you know, ridiculously exaggerated, but it always felt like, oh, that's right. There is still a world that's being affected by all this. And that really helped me dial into it. I totally enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to me because it's funny. I would say Pacific Rim 1 is a better film than the sequel, but I will say the sequel to me was the only one of the two that actually, in my opinion, kind of gave that scope to how big these battles were. I didn't feel when I watched Pacific Rim 1 like how gigantic everything was. It didn't ever equate to me. Also, if I remember correctly, wasn't everything in Pacific Rim 1 at nighttime? Wasn't it very dark? So this one to me, I actually felt more of the scope, and I found this movie. To me, the script isn't great, but the action scenes, there's so many of them, and they're so awesome that I found myself just kind of like, all right, this is kind of mindless fun, and it's weird because sometimes our minds will allow that. Sometimes like you'll be in a mindset where you just want to sit back and just take in some action and have fun with it. I particularly don't think Scott Eastwood's a great actor, but Boyega's great in it. Charlie Day. I there's some things I didn't like about the film, but overall, I found myself just kind of having fun with it. I think the first one's still better, but this one to me has better action. So I feel like if they combined the storytelling of the first one with DeKnight's direction, it would have been like the perfect combination.
Do you want to know the one reason why I don't know if I necessarily prefer this one more, but one thing I liked more about this, they swapped Charlie Hunnam for John Boyega. And Boyega, as much as I like Boyega in everything he's been in, I like him in Attack the Block, and he's really good in the Star Wars movies. This is his movie where he is like, I'm a charismatic leading man who can carry a movie, and he was outstanding in this movie. Yeah.
And he produced it, too, which is a straight... I was, like, surprised to read that he produced the movie. He's a young guy. And, I mean, clearly he knows what he's doing. But I was actually surprised to see him on there. I know Del Toro still produced it. Apparently he signed off on kind of the idea behind the film. But I will say, you know, the cool thing about the movie is it takes place 10 years later. So when they shot the original Pacific Rim, I remember Charlie Hunnam and Idris Elba talking about the filmmaking behind it. And that when they were in the Jaegers, they were on these ellipticals that essentially kind of kept them running, as that was the way that they made it look like they were operating the Jaeger. And now in this one, the technology is kind of upgraded. So now, like, John Boyega is running on a treadmill. It's like a blue treadmill. It's kind of cool how they, like, those scenes are really, really well done. Specifically the Arctic battle with the two Jaegers that are fighting. That scene is awesome. Like, there's some really cool action. I don't think it's a movie I'll look back on.
No, but let me ask. You recommend it? You recommend it?
It was fun. Yeah, I recommend seeing it on a big screen. Like, to me, it was worth the theater experience. But, like, see, this is where it gets interesting. You look at something like Ready Player One, which, in my opinion, has the same or better, in my opinion, visual gravitas as Pacific Rim. But then you also have a great story. And you have great performances. And you have great... So... Ready Player One gave me everything Pacific Rim gave me and more. So it's almost like, they're not... It's hard to compare the two, but they're both massive visual feasts.
Some of us haven't seen Ready Player One yet, Kevin. We have to just talk about...
The only reason I was making that point was because, like, there are... Like, Pacific Rim is, like, a movie that I recommend seeing on the big screen, but it's kind of... It's not a great film by any means.
The conversation that we stemmed after talking about Pacific Rim was sequels that change directors. That it's not the person who launched the franchise, but another filmmaker who stepped into someone else's sandbox and created a better sequel, and that got some really interesting suggestions from all three of us. Jake, you go first, because I'm sure yours is the selection that all three of us would have chosen if we had to pick probably one of the best sequels.
I sort of was a jerk, and I jumped in first as soon as this question was proposed, which I feel bad because I didn't really think about the fact that we're all going to have to choose different ones. But I chose the easy answer, which I think is Empire. Empire
of the Sun?
Strikes Back, of course, following... Yeah, exactly. Empire of the Sun, which is sequel to Moon. No. So yeah. So Empire Strikes Back, of course, following Star Wars, Lucas versus Kirshner. I mean, you know, I think maybe one of the most universally agreed upon better sequels within cinema. Better in terms of action, better in terms of depth, better in terms of rippling significance. Yeah. A almost like a better understanding of what Star Wars was. You know, it's
strange to say. Had a better understanding than Lucas's own creation, but it's true. It's accurate.
I mean that in the sense of like what Star Wars maybe became. Maybe. It's easy for me to say that because I look at Star Wars, what Star Wars was, as the original trilogy. And, you know, and it was interesting when thinking about Empire Strikes Back when Last Jedi came out. Because when Last Jedi came out, people that were defending it went and pulled up a lot of the initial reviews of Empire, which sounded eerily similar to a lot of the complaints that people had about Last Jedi, which made me almost rethink my thoughts on Last Jedi as like, well, are we really just freaking out because it's doing things differently and not what we expected? Empire Strikes Back is far and beyond incredibly different than A New Hope, which obviously wasn't even called A New Hope at the time. It obviously just called Star Wars. So I almost, you know, when I think about what, to me, what the heart of Star Wars is, I think about A New Hope, Empire, and Return of the Jedi all together as one giant picture. And in that vision, Empire is what gets it most right. But at the time, if you think about it, if you only know Star Wars and you go in to see Empire and it's such a completely different film, it takes the entire story into a 180, it is interesting to see how people could have responded negatively to it. So, I mean, to me, it best captures what Star Wars is because I look at it from a giant picture. But I could, you know, it's as easy of an answer as it is. I could also see, you know, have people saying, well, yeah, but it's, you know, just, I think it proved to me that Lucas is a great storyteller, but maybe should have handed the prequels off to other directors. Yeah.
Well, that's why I'm.
Yeah. Yeah, Lucas is not a great director, but it's okay to say that. George Lucas is not a good director. He is a good storyteller. Yeah. And oddly enough, that they are the same thing, technically speaking, in regards to a director is a storyteller. But generally speaking, Lucas does not direct great movies.
Yeah, I'd argue that they're two different things. There are a lot of people down in the streets that I think could tell a great story. Doesn't mean that they can take that story and put it onto film.
Agreed, but a director is a storyteller, but you also have to have that technical ability. I mean, if you look at Spielberg footage behind the scenes, that guy is in every single shot telling the cinematographer. And I'm not saying, I don't know what Lucas looks like when he's directing a movie, but there's something to be said about Lucas as a director. He's not a great director. I think people just kind of think of him as one. And also, you know what's weird about Star Wars? Most people think George Lucas directed the original trilogy. All three of them. Most people don't even know that Irvin Kershner did the second one. I honestly can't remember the name of the third guy who did Jedi.
Richard,
who did Jedi?
Marquand?
I don't know his name.
I want to say.
Who is he? Nothing. What happened
to him? It's George Lucas's pseudonym. It's a pseudonym. All right. So my pick is a situation where an iconic director handed a baton to an iconic director. And I want to play off something that Jake said in that they each played in the same sandbox but came up with completely different films. And my choice is Aliens by James Cameron.
Game over, man. Game over.
Yeah. And I don't even know if this is an actual story or not, or it might just be a legend that's been passed down from person to person. But his pitch, did you guys ever hear about his pitch? Yeah.
Read the dollar
sign. He writes alien on a board, and then he writes an S after it, and then turns it into a dollar sign. And that's basically what Aliens is. It's like...
That sounds like something James Cameron would
completely,
do.
Completely, 100%. So I have to believe that is true. But in addition, like what he did was he just changed completely what you could do in that series. I mean, he took basically still a team of people who were facing off against a threat, but he amplified the personalities. It's so much more aggressive. It's so much more 80s action. It changed Sigourney Weaver completely from the character that she played in the first one to someone who's affected by it. It introduced the character of Newt, who I thought was a nice, relatable character for us to get into, and just it just increased the terror. It's like they're both horror films, but one is so much more psychological, slow burn horror that Sir Ridley does so well, and the other one is just balls to the wall, you know, summer blockbuster, Kind of what Cameron did with True Lies and T2, you know, but doesn't do anymore. And I wish he did, because there's no one better at that type of action storytelling than Cameron was. And he's lost himself in Pandora. And I wish he'd come back, because all this time that he's developing these Avatar sequels, we could have three movies that are just, total stripped down badass action films that Cameron used to be a master of.
It's devastating.
Okay, I have a question.
It's actually devastating to me that he's just lost in Pandora.
Because the movies that are on his really, even does. When he got like a little bit experimental in movies like The Abyss, they were still like edge of your seat action films that he's just on.
Dude, I like Titanic. I would defend Titanic.
I love Titanic.
So. Yeah. Okay, Sean, I have a question for you. Is it an unfair question? And I say this knowing that I'm pretty sure I asked it earlier this week. Considering how different the films are. I'd argue one's a horror film and one's an action film. Is it an unfair question to say what's better, Alien or Aliens?
Yeah, because we did that. We did the discussion in the text message, and they are so different.
Because it almost
different.
Borderline argues, like, comes down to, like, well, do you want to see a horror film or do you want to see an action? Like, you're almost arguing.
The problem of saying that one is better than the other implies that one is bad. And I don't think they are. I think both of them are 10 out of 10. So I don't know what's flawed about. How do you say that one 10 is better than another 10?
I think it sort of just depends on, like, under what context do you like to see the xenomorphs? I think I like my xenomorphs hidden, not really seen, you know, like very sort of like, you know, exposed, almost Jaws-like, singular one, as opposed to xenomorphs running all over the place being shot up.
Yeah.
I wish, you know, Ridley obviously took back over the franchise with Prometheus and Covenant. And I feel like he took, you know, like he was at his best with the xenomorphs when less was more. And, he, you know, it proved that maybe he can't really do it the way Cameron
can. Well, and one thing I like about both of those films, too, or about Aliens, is it's the prototypical female badass action star. And it's that's a role that a lot of studios are chasing right now without understanding it. And Linda Hamilton and Sigourney Weaver created that mold in Terminator 2, specifically in Terminator 2 and in Aliens. And I just think that it's because Cameron believed in those characters. He wasn't trying to, like, tick a box of, oh, we need a female character who can hold her own in a fight. He was just like, no, these are the characters that I want to tell. And that's why they were so genuine and authentic. So,
I mean, Ripley was written as a man, right? And then they just cast a woman.
So, Kevin, who's your pick? What's your pick for a sequel that improved on the original by switching directors?
And I'd like to note for the listener, Kevin got third pick. And so I'd argue that Sean and I got the easy first two. And after those two, I'd argue it gets a little harder, gets a little muddier. So just saying that for Kevin's sake.
No, I will say, in my mind, I'm sorry, my mind was kind of like drifting for a second, Pacific Rim style, because of the idea of Cameron being lost in Pandora. Sean, you said that, I think. It is devastating, like, to me to think that. Like, I mean, like, the guy who made Terminator 2, True Lies, The Abyss, Titanic, Aliens, some of the greatest movies of all time, is just stuck on this Avatar thing, which... And I get it. Business-wise, it made $2 billion, but it's like, come on, man.
It's
like
the biggest movie that no one talks about. Like, how does the highest-grossing film of all time have no impact on pop culture? No one quotes it. It's not referenced in other films. I mean, like, after Titanic, you could not find a street corner or a boat where some just douchebag was saying, "Hey guys, look, I'm the king of the world." I mean, who's saying anything about, like, "Hey, like, you want my tail?" Like, no one's saying anything about Pandora. It has no presence in our pop culture psyche at the moment. I think he lucked out because he made technological advances that hadn't been done yet. If I were him, I'd take my money and run and make your dream project, man. Like, part of me almost wishes that Avatar 2 would bomb. Just so we wouldn't get Avatar 3, 4, and 5, and then he could move on to
something. Okay, but I'll say this. Wait, let me say this.
I
if there's any filmmaker out there who I still do trust to change the game, you know, with a movie that he spent this much time developing, I do believe that Cameron can come back with Avatar 2, and it'll be something where we're like, oh my God, all right, you know what?
But hasn't the 3D, like, train left the station by now? I mean, like, so much was riding on Avatar being in the midst of this 3D surgence. And I feel like it's Cameron dreamed of, unless he can realize his dream, which he's always said that his dream was 3D without glasses. Right. Unless Avatar 2 comes out. And then he did, in fact, find a way to do 3D without glasses, and then that makes it an event again. Unless he does that, it's no longer an event. It's
you know what's funny? He cast Kate Winslet in Avatar 2, and it's like a reunion. It's like, oh, it's Titanic. But you know how he would get me excited about that? Cast Schwarzenegger. Put Schwarzenegger in Avatar 2.
Yes!
And then I'm on board.
Yes.
Dude. I interviewed James Cameron for Avatar, and it was like a radio interview, and I was just starting out at the time, and I was
that's
like...
That's how long ago that
Terminator
was.
2 is my yeah, Terminator 2 is my favorite movie of all time, and I remember like being this, and I felt so dumb asking this question, but I was asking him like how he shot the scene in Terminator 2 when the T-1000 comes out of the floor and then becomes the twin cop and then puts, you know, before he puts his finger through his eye, and James Cameron was like, well, nothing was there. And I was like, he's like ILM.
It was a tennis ball.
But that movie was so great. It was so groundbreaking.
Kevin, what's your pick?
Anyways, I went with Winter Soldier because again, that was also given in the chat chain as well. It is that to me, out of all the movies we are discussing right now, because the Alien and the Aliens jump, they're both great. And Jake, what was yours again? Star Wars, Empire. They're still both good movies. I don't particularly like Captain America, the First Avenger. I thought it was very bland. I thought the effects were kind of cool and how they shrunk down Evans' character. But the jump from First Avenger to Winter Soldier is like, it's leaps and bounds.
That's interesting.
It is the jump, the most gigantic jump in quality I've seen in a franchise, I think. I'll have to think back to other ones, but like, I mean, Batman Begins and Dark Knight, both great movies. Godfather 1, Godfather 2, both great movies. So the jump in that film is just beyond belief. I mean, what the Russos brought to the table, which is why the Russos will always have my anticipation. I mean, the Infinity War is going to be insane, and I'm excited about that because those guys are behind the camera.
It's just rare, and it should happen more often than not, but it's rare when a new voice comes in and makes a franchise more exciting. But you'd think that a fresh voice would always sort of change it up and improve, but that's rarely the case.
The Rock's made an entire career of that.
Very true.
I wish JJ stayed on for the whole trilogy.
I do too.
Of the new Star Wars. I love Rian Johnson, but I was so pumped with Force Awakens, and my wife and I were talking about this the other day. I at the end of Jedi, we mentioned this before, I don't know what I'm looking forward to now except for how JJ is going to fix things. In my mind, that's kind of all what I'm thinking. I feel like, can you imagine if JJ did the second one? I mean, I feel like
well,
we'd be in a
he did Star
totally
Trek Into Darkness also.
Right
Sometimes
now.
I think JJ is enough with one film.
Hey, I love Super 8.
No,
yeah,
he's an extremely gifted filmmaker, but sometimes I think he puts a lot of his tricks. He did Mission Impossible 3. Wildly entertaining.
Awesome.
But
movie.
Maybe he that's good that he did one and moved on. Who knows? Who knows?
Hey, I'm still waiting on Super 9, dude. I want Super 9.
It's called Stranger Things.
MI3.
It's on Netflix right now. You can watch it right now.
MI3 is probably another one of those jumps. I don't love MI1, and I thought MI2, I went through a big John Woo phase in high school, so like Face Off, I saw Face Off 45 times.
Mission Impossible 2 was fun.
Mr. Possible 2 is fun, but the jump in quality...
Well, if you're talking about a jump in quality in that franchise, I think the jump from 3 to 4. Brad Bird is incredible.
3 to 4?
Oh, yeah.
4 is my favorite in that
Ghost Protocol
franchise.
Is amazing.
Jake and I were on the red carpet in New York for that. I remember, like, we just were, like... Everyone was excited about Tom Cruise, of course, but we were, like, geeking out because, like,
Giacchino.
We saw Michael Giacchino.
Remember, we got J.J. Abrams, and he seemed surprised that anyone wanted to talk to him.
Yeah.
Because, obviously, he was the producer on the film, like, no one, you know, and I remember we went up to him, and he was like, oh, like, you guys want to interview me? And we're like, J.J. Abrams, yes, we would like to interview you. Yes, we would.
Please.
All right.
Yeah, I was talking to him about that bridge stunt when Tom Cruise gets blown back into the car. That's one of the coolest stunt scenes ever in a movie. So
you guys want to see some good JJ directing work? Watch the pilot of Lost.
Yes,
I need to watch.
You've
Lost.
Got to, man.
I just feel like I missed the boat on that one.
Or the plane.
We have to go back.
That's the sound of me slapping my knee for people.
So again, I say this every week, but I have to keep reminding everybody or complimenting everybody how happy I am with the Scorsese blend hashtag on social media, bringing in some amazing answers for people when we asked what is the best Martin Scorsese film, and where the three of us are going to try to dive into it and sort of explain to you what we think is the best film. Now, again, it's not our favorite film, and that's what gets really complicated with some of these conversations, because favorite and best are often different. And again, when we're sort of picking these out, I think, well, here's what I do. I don't know if you guys do this too. I really try to figure out the film that defines, or I try to figure out the types of stories that the filmmaker likes to tell, and then try to pick the best example of that one. And that's what made Paul Thomas Anderson so difficult, because I think he makes a different film almost every time that he goes out. Scorsese, it's a little bit easier to define him. He sort of goes after a lot of the same themes in not all of his films, but the majority of his films. And so, Producer Gabe, tell me, is there an order that we need to go in, or what's it? No, it doesn't matter. All right, good. Then I'm going to go first. I guess you guys have to guess what you think mine is. So give me your guesses really fast, and then I'll tell you if you're right.
I think it's Goodfellas.
I think Goodfellas as well.
You are both correct.
Wow. And, by the tone of that, I thought you were going to say we were both wrong. No. Like the way you shouted at us with your finger.
Okay, so I was really torn between Raging Bull and Goodfellas. But I just feel, and for this reason, I'll talk quickly about Raging Bull, and just saying Scorsese is, his Catholicism defines all of the things that weigh on that poor man's shoulders. Like, he is just a tortured soul, and he explores so many themes of, like, guilt and responsibility in his movies. And Raging Bull, Jake LaMotta is an incredible character, and the fact that he shot in black and white, and the different frame ratios that he uses to do Raging Bull is a freaking masterpiece. However, I think Goodfellas is the type of movie that Scorsese loves to direct, which is, he has this fascination growing up in Little Italy with the mafia characters, with the Italian gangster. And to make a movie like Goodfellas, which has to, by definition, exist in the shadow of Coppola's two Godfather films, and to, I'm not going to say best them, but to at least create something that stands shoulder to shoulder with them and tells a similar story in a different way. I mean, he immerses you in this extremely violent, totally unpredictable world of these short-tempered Italian gangsters. And Goodfellas terrifies me in a way that few horror films do. And it's just Pesci. You never know when Pesci's going to go off.
Okay.
I'm funny.
That's
you.
A really good point, I'm funny Sean, to you about standing on the heels of Godfather. That's a really good
because
point.
Because at that point, when Goodfellas came out, it wasn't that many years after Godfather. What? It was maybe 15 years?
I mean, Godfather's
but even still, like 20 these days, as we get older, 20 is not that much.
No, it's not. And I mean, it almost felt like the whole time that Scorsese was coming up making Taxi Driver and Mean Streets and that everyone was like, yeah, but you should make a gangster movie, right? And he was probably like, I don't want to rush into doing that. He really explored some, and then Raging Bull, of course. And then he finally came around to that story, which is just Henry Hill and how he got invited into the family, essentially. And it's a classic, you know, sort of rise and fall of these flawed characters. But it does, and this is why, so I get into this on social media with a lot of people. This is why I don't like The Departed. Goodfellas does to me so well all the things that Scorsese plays with, his musical cues, you know, where he pulls all the classic rock references and plays them at the perfect time, his montages, the way that he uses De Niro and Pesci, so that's why I'm fired to see what he does in The Irishman. And then when he tried to do it again in The Departed, it just felt to me, so The Departed lives in the shadows of Goodfellas in the way that I think Goodfellas lives in the shadows of Godfather, but Departed to me can't distance itself from Goodfellas. It's just, to me, it's always inferior. So I'm never able to see it as its own separate thing, and that's why I'm disappointed by it. But I think, so to me, for all those reasons, I think Goodfellas is Scorsese's best. And it's so good. I popped it in and rewatched it.
It's so good.
It's amazing. And
it's an easy 3-hour watch.
It is. But it never lags. There's never a segment of it where I'm like, oh, well, I can skip through this part because this isn't important. It's riveting from start to finish.
Yeah.
Kevin, you are on the clock, and we get to guess what your pick is.
Wait. I can't go next, because mine I think is going to be a bit controversial.
Oh,
so.
Oh God.
Okay.
I think we need to go with Jake.
Okay.
Wait, we get to guess.
All right, you have to guess.
Jake's.
I also think Jake. I would have guessed Goodfellas also, but
Gabe, I would have guessed Goodfellas
Gabe
too.
Told us.
Goodfellas is my favorite, but it's not what I think is his best.
I'm going to go with Raging Bull.
I will say Taxi Driver.
Raging Bull.
Oh, it's a good choice. I mean,
for a lot of the reasons, almost the exact opposite of the reasons that you picked Goodfellas is why I picked Raging Bull. He did not want to make that movie. He had to be pushed into it by De Niro. He very much, he had no interest in boxing, didn't really care about who Jake LaMotta was. Yeah. De Niro was really the one that pushed it. If you get the chance, find a copy of the Raging Bull script with De Niro's notes in the edges. It's absolutely brilliant. It's almost as brilliant as the actual screenplay is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people that know Scorsese know that he was dealing with a lot of personal demons in the late 70s and early 80s. And so in that way, I feel like Raging Bull is the closest to like an autobiographical film that we'll ever get. In a lot of ways, I think what's interesting is because he had to sort of be pushed into that, not only did sort of he discover a lot of interesting things about Jake LaMotta and what fascinated him, I think as a filmmaker, he discovered a lot of interesting things about himself. And I think a lot of aspects of from that point on of what made Scorsese great were birthed out of Raging Bull. Mm. I mean, you talk about, mm-hmm. you know, just the direction. Arguably, I would take the Pepsi Challenge. I would put that down as De Niro's greatest performance.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of soul searching, a lot of personal demons exercised in that film, and not just through the character. You know, Sean, you talked about how it sort of felt right for him to make Goodfellas, and in a way, that's what makes that film brilliant. I mm-hmm. think what makes Raging Bull brilliant is that it didn't feel right, and he mm-hmm. did it anyway. And through that, sort of genius was born. Genius came out of both of these films, but I like sort of that self-discovery of his own personal demons. I mean, obviously, you know, people that are even somewhat familiar with his work know that sort of discovering his demons through Catholicism was a massive deal. That's why he ended up making Silence, which I'm glad he got to make because he wanted to make it for years, even if I wasn't a big fan of it. I would argue, you know, not that I would ever tell this to his face, but like Raging Bull was his Silence. Like Raging Bull was that Catholic, that Catholic sort of discovery of demons.
You know what I like about Scorsese though is that he's never fully comfortable with it. Like even at this late age, he's still wrestling with it. He's never, he doesn't come to conclusions. He's constantly exploring it. And I find that to be really exciting about him.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, so funny because like almost like beat for beat, the things that you said about Goodfellas, I would swap it and say those are the exact reasons that I picked Raging Bull.
It's definitely Thelma's best work as an editor also.
And like I said, Goodfellas is my favorite. I mean, you say, okay, let's sit down and watch one. I say, let's sit down and watch Goodfellas. But in terms of like, holy crap, where, you know, if we're using the literal definition of the word masterpiece, which is one, just picking his one, because I think the word masterpiece gets used a lot these days, but picking someone's greatest achievement, I would say Scorsese's masterpiece is Raging Bull.
Right. No, I agree. We lost Kevin.
He said that his pick was controversial, but I didn't realize it was so controversial that he was afraid to give it to us.
Let's give him a second to see if he comes back around. Jake, I want to ask you this question to see before he weighs back in. So we both picked, you know, films from years ago for Scorsese, but is there a movie of his somewhat recently? Because I debated Gangs of New York, and I thought that it could get in. That's his Leo period. You know, he went through his De Niro period, and now he's doing Leo. Do you have a more recent one?
I was a big fan of Hugo. I was a massive champion of Hugo. I mean, honestly, like, I think Gangs of New York, I think I would probably have to agree with you. But picking a different film in his modern age, I just think, you know, Hugo, honestly, I think Wolf of Wall Street, just, and if you just think about it in the sense of, like, that's a 70-plus-year-old man who directed one of the most unbelievably, insanely frenetic 3-hour films I've ever seen in my entire life. Right. Arguably one of DiCaprio's best performance. I'd say his best performance is in Django. But I mean, I was exhausted by the time I finished seeing It is exhausting.
Yeah, that's why. Too long for me, unfortunately. It goes on for so long that I have to finally wave the white flag and just be like, I can't keep up with this anymore. It's overkill. But I definitely understand that point. I think Kevin's out. I think the snowstorm sort of knocked him out.
For people that maybe might listen to this a few days down the line or a few weeks down the line, there's a massive nor'eastern pounding New York and D.C. right now. Somehow I'm supposed to get on a flight to New York tomorrow. We'll see how that. We'll see how that pans out. I'm hearing that. Hopefully it all happens today. So tomorrow is the cleanup day. So hopefully I can still get in.
Wait, can producer Gabe tell us what Kevin's?
Wait. I really want to know.
Guys, wait. Oh, hold on.
Oh, hey, nice.
Power's back on.
Woo! All right, good.
People who are listening, we have a snowstorm here in DC, so it totally knocked my power out apparently. So sorry about that.
Kevin, you're up. Give us your pick.
Okay, can you guys see me again?
Yeah.
Yes. There he is.
Wait, I'm back on video. All right, and Gabe, I'm sorry. I guess some of the snow here must have knocked out our power, so I apologize.
Dude, you have an excuse. You have a massive snowstorm pounding you right now.
I will say, it's a massive snowstorm for us. I mean, if this was like a Chicago snowstorm, this would be like a raining day for you guys, because don't you guys get crazy snow? So,
I mean, honestly, I feel like we're not going to turn this into a weather podcast, but like these past few weeks, you guys have been bad. Much more than we have here in Chicago.
Well, specifically now, this is bad. This is really bad. All right.
We get to guess Kevin's pick. Ooh. Because he said controversial, so I'm going to guess.
I'm actually worried now because of the argument you presented about the films you did, and I think I was bad.
Did you hear any of my Raging Bull?
I heard everything you said about Raging Bull and him fighting his demons and finding, you know, to me that was how I felt about Jaws. The reason I chose Jaws is because I felt like Jaws is what made Spielberg the filmmaker he is today because of the problems he encountered in that movie. So, oddly enough, now I'm wondering if my pick is the right one, but we'll see.
Dude, I'm really curious. Like, what intrigues me about this is that you said it was going to cause controversy or that it was going to make us mad.
I know what it is.
You know what it is?
I know what it is. Yeah. If only because I spent a lot of time with Kevin when he saw this movie, and I know how much he adores it.
Is it Wolf of Wall Street?
My guess is Hugo.
Jake?
Jake says Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah.
It's Hugo.
Yeah, wow. I knew Kevin adores Hugo. Wow. He loves it.
Here's why. Yeah, it's awesome. Hugo to me is the movie that Scorsese was meant to make, I really mean that. And when I watch, it's an interesting choice, and it's definitely not a normal Scorsese pick.
But it's his love letter to cinema.
That's why I
know
love it.
You. Yeah,
that's why I think it's his best movie. And I will say this. My mind is a bit on the favorite side too with this but I also think it's his best designed film, shot wise. And this is very weird, and this goes against everything I stand for in regards to digital and filmmaking and filmmaking. This movie was shot digitally. It's his first digital movie.
Right.
But to me, it is the greatest idea or the greatest example of why 3D needs to be a thing if the right filmmaker and right cinematographer are behind the lens. Mm-hmm. When you sit there and you watch Hugo, Robert Richardson's cinematography and Scorsese's storytelling, there is nothing. I've never felt depth of field like that in my life. I've never felt like, to me, it was, I felt like I could walk up to the screen and jump in to this world.
Wait, let me ask you a question. How many times did you see it in a theater?
Saw it three times in theaters.
Was the 3D that good every time? Did it depend on presentation?
It depended on the bulb. And I remember, I'll never forget this because if a theater had a bad bulb in their projector or whatever, I remember Scorsese talking about this because the glass is already darkened the experience for you. My wife and I have a 3D TV and we have 3D glasses, and we were just watching Hugo in 3D before we did the podcast, and the depth of field is amazing. So on top of all that, technically speaking, the 3D is incredible. The storytelling's amazing. I love the journey that Hugo goes on, and then the revelation of Ben Kingsley's character being just reinventing that love of cinema and being gone for so long. And then Michael Stuhlbarg, who plays the author of the book, at finding out that his favorite filmmaker of all time is alive. Mm-hmm. And then that moment when they sit down, they turn that projector on. I just, that film blew my mind. I know it's completely different than anything he ever did. It's a PG movie. It's nothing like anything he ever did. And
it's his BFG.
But honestly, I think it's the movie he was meant to make. I think it is. I think it's Scorsese just kind of. I think Scorsese is that kid or that author. I think he's like a lot of those characters. Because I just think that when we, oh my God, the scene when the papers are flying around the room and the 3D in that movie to me is a leading character. And I remember just kind of like being blown away by how immersed I was in what he created. That opening shot into the train station, the smoke, the train smoke, the dust. On top of that, Howard Shore's score is unbelievable. It is a perfect score. Every performance, Sacha Baron Cohen is unbelievable in the movie. Ben Kingsley, amazing. Asa Butterfield, Jude Law. But I mean, it is, again, and I know it's a very different choice and it's not in line with what. But it is an interesting one, and I know that like good, but if you're in a film studies class, you're probably gonna look at the movies you guys mentioned: Goodfellas, The Mean Streets, the Taxi Drivers, the Raging Bulls. But it's funny to me because I don't know. There's something about Hugo that spoke to me personally. So I think there's a lot of blending here, real blending here of my love of cinema, but also watching a filmmaker lose his love of cinema and then regain it in the story. And I just found that to be the most beautifully poetic. When they go, remember that scene when they, I was just watching it again, so I remember it pretty vividly just seeing it. But when they go back to Michael Stuhlbarg's character as a kid and he visits that set that Kingsley's shooting on, and they have like the dropping the lobsters into the water. And then the old time projectors and like him having like the old camera that Ben Kingsley used to shoot on, and there's one movie left that out of all the movies he ever made, and like it's like this masterpiece in a tin. I don't know. To me, it was just, it's a beautiful film, and I think that I do think that it is his best movie because he couldn't have made it. And I remember Jake and I interviewed him for this. I don't think he could have made this film until he made it. Like this is not a movie he could have made as a young filmmaker. He needed his history, his filmography, to build him up to this.
Do we have time for a quick story? One of my greatest achievements, one of my favorite accomplishments in my career, is getting a one-on-one with Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
But Kevin's story of getting him. It's fantastic. Do we have time for Kevin's story?
Wait, is this sitting in the junket room just like until the end of the day?
We both had a similar experience.
I thought you both did that.
Well, we both did.
Yeah.
Because neither of you guys were on the list. Let me set it because I was on the list. Oh, you were? Okay,
yeah.
So a lot of times we go to these junkets and we're told that you're going to get all the actors for a certain movie. And if it's someone like Scorsese or even Spielberg, like even Kevin with Ready Player One didn't know whether he had Spielberg to the very end. And these guys were both, and I remember this, I was sitting in the room with them. They were told, you might get Scorsese, or Kevin was told, you might get Scorsese, but it might be like one question at the end of the day. And I said to you, Kevin, I said, you're nuts. I would not sit here for the entire day for the possibility of maybe getting to ask him one question. I just didn't see the value in that. And you did it.
It was worth it. I mean, he gave me a 5-minute answer. So what happened with that was, kind of briefly, at the time I booked that junket, I was still working a full-time sales job, 9 to 5, at CBS Radio. And I think the junket, if I remember correctly, was originally supposed to be during the week. It was like a Thursday, Friday, or Wednesday, Thursday initially. And I couldn't get off, even though my boss, even though I was offered Martin Scorsese, it crushed me because I didn't want to get fired. I couldn't move back home with my family. And now, looking back on it now, I probably should have just said screw it and just went to the junket anyways. But I ended up getting it, so it worked out. But so I turned down the junket. I can't believe I'm saying that. And I turned it down, and then they moved the junket to Friday, Saturday, if I remember correctly. And so by that time, I had lost my Scorsese slot. And I still wanted to do the junket because I wanted to cover a Martin Scorsese movie so badly. So I go to New York and I go to the Paramount people. I'm like, is there any way you can get back on the list? They said, no, his time is super limited. Just show up in the morning and we'll try. And I remember showing up, it was like 10 a.m. and I didn't get him till 4 p.m. or 3:55
because
he had to.
Because remember they cut back because I was on the list. I was going to get him. And when I showed up that morning, they said, hey, he just cut back like 3/4 of his time.
Right.
Like you were one of the people that we had to cut from the list. So then Kevin and I began, sort of said, well, we're going to sit here.
Yeah.
And you're almost going to literally have to drag us from this hospitality suite.
Seriously.
I think, remember, at a certain point, we were like, well, we'd at least like to maybe see him and shake his hand.
That's all I was, at the end of it, that's kind of what I thought was going to happen. I thought that my interaction with him was going to be him leaving into the hallway, going into the elevator and leaving. They told me I had a 0.001% chance of getting him. And I was like, well.
Which, if you know Kevin McCarthy at all, you know you made a mistake by saying that.
Yeah, just don't even tell him
I just wanted to visually see him. So I remember, they were cutting people out. Jake was one of the ones who was cut, but he still stayed because what ended up happening was as they cut more people, time started a little bit opening up. Jake went in, got him as he was originally supposed to, but because he waited, some people got cut and just left. And then so then I was just sitting in the hospitality kind of like scoping things out. And I remember one of the ladies comes over and kind of waves her hand at me and goes, all right, you have literally one question. And I'm like, I don't care. It's fine. One question's fine. I run down the hallway. He had a hard out at 4:00. I'll never forget this. It was like 3:57 or something like that.
Ooh.
Or 3:55. They threw me in the room. I asked one question. It was a 5-minute and 15-second answer, which was like just surreal. He went through his entire career breaking down other films of his that he wished he had shot in 3D. And he was like, Taxi Driver would have been cool to see De Niro in the mirror in 3D and Raging Bull in 3D and like Aviator in 3D. I'm like sitting there. I'm like, my jaw, if you look at the reaction shots in that interview, my jaw is just like hitting the floor. And I'm like, I only have one question. And I'm like, thank God he went through his whole filmography with me. And that was it. And it was like, And it was one of the most surreal. And then so Jake and I.
If you ask, if you ask me top 5 interviews in my life, I Scorsese is in my top 5.
We had a very very surreal day. And Jake and I were so passionate about getting him that there was no in our mind. And like and for me, I was like, if I have a 0.1% chance of getting him, that's enough for me to wait till 4:00.
Whereas if you guys can't tell by listening to the podcast, I'm the cynical one in the three of them who was like, what? I gotta miss dinner? No, I gotta go. I'll catch Scorsese on the next one. So the audience picks are in. Clear winner, Goodfellas.
Yeah, I figured it would be.
It makes
Goodfellas
sense.
Which is a great Scorsese
pick.
Blend. But other picks that came in, Raging Bull, Wolf of Wall Street, and then The Departed. No one, I'm surprised the three of us, that you two didn't pick The Departed.
I love The Departed, but I feel like The Departed is Scorsese making a movie that he thinks Scorsese should make.
Yeah. No, I know.
It's a great movie, though.
The Departed, to me, feels like you handed a premise to another filmmaker and said, try to make a Martin Scorsese movie.
Yeah.
And it has all of his tricks, but to me, employed. It happens really early on when Nicholson's supposed to be a younger version of his character, and he comes into a bar and he's shadowed because they don't want to do like aging. They don't want to de-age him. And like this Rolling Stones song comes up awkwardly, and it's like a bad cue, and I'm like, that doesn't fit. Someone's trying to pretend to be Scorsese, and the movie never comes together for me.
I do want to say one thing. I'm going back to Scorsese real quick. You gotta watch Jake's interview with him as well, because that answer he gave about it, like just like the whole scope of his family and like the emotional tie to that. I mean, he was like really open. It was like really, it's an incredible interview. Watch Jake's interview on YouTube if you can find it. But like, that was a pretty personal. Remember, he got really personal.
It was nice. I mean, he seems like a personal guy. Like, I don't credit myself. I just think he seems like a person that's open. Obviously, I think he sort of put his heart on his sleeve with all of his films.
Yeah, but didn't he talk about his daughter and stuff like that? Didn't he like go into really deep? Like, it was like a really, I don't know. To me, I just never heard him open up like that before.
Jake held him. Jake put his arms around him.
No, but
come here, Marty.
And I whispered him to sleep, and I said, "You will speak to Kevin McCarthy. You will speak to Kevin."
All right, do you guys want to know next week's assignment?
Yeah,
we do Coen Brothers
conversation. We are doing Coen Brothers.
Yes.
Ooh, hashtag Coen Brothers.
There's such a difference between favorite and best. I don't know what I'm going to do.
So start doing your research. If you're listening to us at home, we're going to debate the best Coen Brothers movie next week. And we're going to finally get to talk in depth about Ready Player One because all of us will have seen it. So Jake's got to get going to his screening. So this has been Real Blend number 13. You can listen to us every week here. We're going to be Thursday. I think we're doing Thursday the 29th of next week because that way everybody will have been able to go see Ready Player One. You can find us online. We're at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, and at Sean_O'Connell. Please, if you're listening to us later after the fact, after the live show on iTunes, you can drop a review there. You can give us a star rating. All of that stuff helps us with Apple's standings. And like I mentioned, we will be back next Thursday, March 29th. Of course, pay attention to all of our socials and we will share when we're going live here on the Facebook page. And then, of course, if you guys are downloading us on all different places. So we say...
Sean, real quick, the hashtag though.
Yes.
Hashtag Coen Bros Blend, right? Coenbros Blend. Coen Bros Blend. Okay.
So yes. Coen Bros Blend. Producer Gabe just confirmed this. Yes, it is Coen Bros Blend.
That's actually a really hard one because
that might be the hardest. I feel like I say this every week. But that generally hello, might be the hardest.
They've all been impossible.
Spielberg was probably the hardest one for me because, Oh, that's going to be tough.
I mean,
Blood
I
Simple, man, Blood Simple is a freaking masterpiece. The beer shot down the bar, oh.
Yeah, I know. They haven't made a bad
Gabe,
movie.
Okay, Gabe's giving us the rap.
Gabe is giving us the rap. Thank you very much, everybody, for tuning in. And this is Real Blend number 13, and we will talk to you guys next week. Thanks so much.
Dunkirk!
From Friday night football to the county fair, from picnics in the park to hometown parades, from big cities to small towns, we are proud to serve our communities. Last year, we volunteered 19,000 hours and donated $5 million to local charities. Because lending a hand to a neighbor and investing in the people and places around us is the right thing to do. We are Park National Bank, and we are proud to serve you.
Member FDIC.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.